Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 277 featuring the amazing Ben Proctor. I have wanted to have Ben on the podcast probably since we began, Kristen. I'm thinking forever because I've known Ben for a long, long time and he's an incredible person, but he has been extremely busy and has not necessarily been able to come on, but somehow there was a little bit of easy time where he was able to come on because of COVID. Yeah. And it's been pretty amazing, but he's been working for the last, 7 years I said on the podcast?
Seven. Mm-hmm.
7 years. What has he been working on?
Avatar sequel.
Yeah.
So excited.
Yeah. He's been working on Avatar forever. That's his investment right now. And they're filming the second and third, but I think there's going to be a lot more of it. Sounds like there are plans for four more or five more of these Avatar movies.
Oh,
you're excited, right?
Yes. I love Avatar.
Really?
I see you. Yeah. From the
movie. Okay.
Yes. Big fan.
All right. Yep. Yeah. Titanic too, I'm sure.
So you're a Cameron it's my fan. Number one. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're a big Cameron fan. Well, that's great. So yeah, Ben has been an awesome. He's a concept artist, art director, creative director, and a really cool guy. I met him long time ago before I even went into visual effects. He was working at PLF, which is Pixel Liberation Front, which was really cool. You guys should listen to the Colin Green episode that I did with him for that. But I also work with him more directly on Tron. So he was working on Tron. And it was sort of the first time I've been able to work with the concept art department much more directly because they were creating the assets in 3D. And at the time, that was a really novel idea. Now it's actually much more common, but it was kind of novel and kind of awesome to have that. And it was really cool to talk to Ben. Obviously, he's had a really rich history. What are some of the takeaways that you had, obviously, besides being excited about Avatar?
Well, he's worked on so many large blockbuster films. It was insane. Uh-huh. And you guys also talk about kind of how, even though with COVID, with Avatar right now, their timeline for release is still going strong and they're able to do it virtually. So that was cool. You guys touched on that.
Yeah.
And then you also talked about how art department works with the visual production right now. And he says how the physical is still needed. And it is very beneficial in the virtual process as well. So I liked hearing about that. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was really great about sort of describing all of those different things and doing that. And he's a really cool, soft-spoken person. I really like Ben. He's a very smart guy and really into what he does. So it was pretty awesome to talk to him and to have that sort of input from him and get a little bit more about all of that stuff. So really cool to have Ben on and to do about that. Do we have any announcements? We have just a couple of things we want to announce, right?
Yep. Couple quick announcements, and you can find all this at chaosgroup.com. But we have two updates. We have V-Ray for Houdini update 1 just came out, and then our V-Ray Next for Revit update 1 is available.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we announced Revit last week. There's a lot of cool stuff that's going on there. But Houdini is a big one as well. So you guys should definitely check out some of the Houdini updates. I know some of you big VFX nerds are going to want to check that out because obviously it's a big update on that side. This is not a V-Ray 5 update. This is just a update from Next from some of the features. So just keep that in mind. In terms of V-Ray 5, V-Ray 5 for Max beta is out. So if you guys are interested in V-Ray 5 and finding out all the brand new features, this is the 3ds Max is the first platform that we're putting it out on. You should definitely check it out, and you can go check it out at chaosgroup.com as well. So go do that, V-Ray 5 for 3ds Max beta. And I think that's all we're going to announce today, right? Oh, I do want to note that we are doing this as a video, but this was the early days. We recorded this early days of us going into isolation, and we didn't really have the brilliant idea of recording video back then. So there is no video of Ben. So we're still going to put the video up just to keep continuity, because apparently some people, including Vlado, likes to watch the YouTubes or listen to the YouTubes while he's working. He likes that version. So we're going to keep video thing going on YouTube, even though we're not doing video. So just a note, it's just Kristen and I in video now, but then after that, you're going to switch to just a still image after this. So, all right. Anything else, Kristen? If people want to find out more about the podcast, where can they go?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
Great. And of course, remember, on our Facebook page, we are actually posting the videos up there as well. So you guys can check that out. Make sure you give us feedback, if any ideas. And if you want to give us any new ideas, we've been getting some great ones. Go to labs@chaosgroup.com. You can email us there if you have any comments, questions, or ideas for guests. Please let us know. We'd love to hear from you. That being said, please enjoy this awesome podcast with Mr. Ben Proctor.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passé. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
And I have started recording. So a couple things we're going to do first. So normally, I know, you've listened to this in my podcast, and you've seen a couple of them, right? Mm-hmm. And we normally do Polaroids, but of course I can't be with people in person anymore, so I can't do the Polaroids. So what I actually have is, I forgot to bring it in here to show you, but I have a machine that is basically, you take your phone and you put it on top and it spits out a Polaroid.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
It takes a Polaroid. It's basically like makes a physical Instagram of your Instagram. It's
That's
really
super
funny.
Cool. Wow.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a screenshot of you and I'm going to make that into something. All right. So we're going to use that. Yeah. Got it. Perfect.
All righty.
All right. We're good. All right, Ben. I have actually been wanting to have you on the podcast for a very long time. And I don't know, can you say what movie you've been working on for the last 7 years?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And you've got the right number. It's been 7 years. I've been on the Avatar sequels since late 2013. So yeah, it's been quite a while.
Yeah.
It's hard even for me to believe.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I remember people saying the same thing when they were on the first Avatar, like some of the concept artists on that, they said, I've been working on that for like, they were like 10 years.
There were people who, who'd been picking away at it for many, many years. I think there was an initial phase where they were working at Jim's house, you know, way back in the day. And then there was a more recent one that led up to the period where I was working, where again, they were out at Jim's house in Malibu and working with him, which must have been cool.
Right.
But then, yeah, I mean, let's see. For me, it was a year and a half, which is a long, long time. But I was also on Transformers 1 for a year and a half, so it was not unprecedented for me at that point. But 7 years is a different deal. I mean, you work for a company now, so you understand.
Yeah.
That for me, as someone who normally works as a freelance, in fact, a union employee of movie productions, to be working for this length of time for one employer is just bizarre. Like with the same people for that many years, it's bizarre. It's just not how it's supposed to be. I should be working on something for 3 months, 9 months, a year and a half, whatever. But no complaints. It's been terrific. You know, the Avatar team from top to bottom. I mean, right from, Jim and John, who's terrific, our producer, to everybody, the hundreds of people that are working on it. You know, if you had to be stuck with a certain family of coworkers for that long, I think we're all in good company, so no complaints.
That's great to hear. Now, because I think there's a lot of misinformation about it, and so you would know best. How many Avatars are being produced right now? How many films are being produced? Does anyone know? Can tell me that?
So we have scripts and initial concept art for 4 new movies. Right.
Okay.
Originally, there were 3 scripts. So there were 3 planned sequels. It turned out that the what was going to be Avatar 2 had so much amazing story in it that it literally couldn't fit into a movie at the end of the day. Right. So that got split. So the Avatar 2 and 3 that we are currently finishing out, I guess you'd say we're in post now. We're in a strange state of being both in the middle of live action, in the sense that we've done a stint of live action photography, but we still are going to do at least one more. Right.
Right.
But at the same time in post, right, because it's such a heavily digital movie that a huge amount of virtual production is completely wrapped in all the motion editing and all of the actual film editing and Jim's specific virtual camera moves and all everything that goes into the finishing pipeline of Avatar. That's all has already been started, obviously, and been Weta Digital has been working on shots for quite a long time in certain right. cases, but that turnover pipeline process is now in full gear. So I guess to answer your question, there are four new potential avatars out there, right? We have yeah. we are in the middle of producing basically two and three concurrently, if I can say that. I mean, okay. the emphasis clearly is a lot more on two because we got to get that finished and get it out.
When is that coming out?
So holiday 2021 is two.
Okay. So we still yeah. have, almost 2 years.
Almost 2 years, which in normal world is like, oh, wow, we could make like four movies in that time. But in Avatar right. world means just because the complexity of what we're doing and the ambition of what we're doing means that we're under the gun. So, but we're still going. I mean, despite the coronavirus shutdown of so many things, I feel terrible to say this, you know, in front of my industry colleagues, but, you know, we are still going. We've gone to a virtual office sort of a setup.
Yeah.
And so far, you know, it seems to be working pretty well. We have meetings and reviews and everything that we normally do.
It is interesting to see the things that can work and things that can't work, you know, because there are things that can work. And, you know, if you have the internet has been basically saving everyone's jobs.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
It's amazing that it's holding up. I mean, I probably shouldn't say that, but the fact that the yeah. bandwidth of the internet is actually holding up right now, given the amount of video being thrown around, is insane, including what we're doing right now.
Right. I know. You know? This going on, the amount of video conferences going on, the amount of Netflix streaming that's going on, and,
yeah.
and it's working. So
yeah. Yeah.
It's probably just about to burst. But
it's probably like, about to burst, exactly.
But yeah. if we have been able to operate basically for the last few weeks this way, it's been pretty interesting. I find it fascinating. But before we get to, I know we've already started and what's going to happen in your future, but let's go back to the past because that's always mm-hmm. something that's interesting. And I remember the first time I met you in person was at PLF. You were still at PLF.
Was it then? That's yeah. so funny because I would have said Tron, but I forgot that we met before that.
Yeah, because awesome. I had was first moved to LA and I was interested in finding out more about visual effects world and stuff like that. And I, of course, Eric Hansen, who's introduced sure. everyone to everyone.
Exactly.
he's the one who introduced me to you. And so he said, and I said, hey, I'd love to go visit you at PLF. And I went there and you guys were just crammed full of people. It was the first time yeah. I'd seen one of those situations where
there was no was social elbow distancing, to elbow. That's for sure.
yeah. Elbow to elbow working.
Yeah.
And I think I met for a brief second, you introduced me to Colin Green.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's actually been on the podcast.
Has he? Terrific.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah,
awesome.
He's been on.
I'm ashamed to admit I've only listened to like four of your podcasts, but I've enjoyed every single one. So I've got to expand my reading,
but
so to speak.
PLF was kind of an interesting thing. That was obviously, you know, that was the days when the idea of previs was kind of a new thing. And,
yeah.
And there was a really cool thing. So what landed you at PLF? How did you end up there?
Well, look, I'll start, if I can, at my yeah. very first, quote unquote, Hollywood job was working at a tiny little kind of fly-by-night matte painting company run by a guy whose name I won't mention,
okay.
Who's not highly regarded by some of the people that worked for him at that time.
Yeah.
And it was literally in Hollywood, and I had to commute to, like, the shadow of the Capitol Records building, and I felt like, oh, my God, I've moved from New York out to L.A. I'm really doing it. But we were also working literally like slaves. And I was so tired. I got into a car accident. And as a New Yorker, I didn't know how to drive very well. I was just learning literally on the fly in LA, how to drive. And it was a nightmare.
How old were you at this point?
I guess I must've been, that's a great question. 26, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. So you were really New Yorker, New Yorker. Where 26...
I was a New Yorker, New Yorker. Exactly. No, that a good point. Right. So yeah, but at that age, I had not yet learned to drive, and I did a little bit of learning in Manhattan from a company that mainly specialized in training like big rig drivers. So that this idiot, this 26-year-old idiot wandering who didn't know how to drive a car was not treated with much respect, and I had some
wow.
some hijinks. I think, sorry, I'm going off topic, but one driver, you know, a teacher, I should say, came in with a boombox and smoking, right? Like gets into the car, puts the boombox on the dash, almost blocking my view, hits play on whatever it was, starts smoking. He's like, all right, go.
And, this is your teacher. Oh my god!
My teacher, and it had a double control. So he got me onto the West Side Highway, which anybody who knows New York is, it's kind of like as close to a freeway as you get, right? It's like a several lane, like two or three lane highway, effectively, that runs around the island, right? So he gets us out of there, and he's like, "All right, you go. It's yours now." And I take control. He's like, "All right, change lanes. Do this, that." So he had me essentially doing kind of freeway driving in Manhattan, you know. And I didn't know. And anyway, I almost got us killed. And he was like, "What happened there?" Dude, I don't know how to drive. That's what happened there. What do you think? So anyway,
wow.
Somehow I survived that, survived my crash in LA, you know, as I moved out here. And so basically that was my first job. And then PLF, frankly, was just one of the guys that was working at the map painting company said, "Hey, you know, here's a few job listings I've seen." It was like literally a random job listing kind of deal. And so I went in. I had no particular interest, or knowledge of Previz or what PLF did. Obviously, I found it interesting once I got there. Right. But at that point, you know, my brain in terms of wanting to be in movies was much more about CG and visual effects and, you know, wanting to be like a texture artist at a Pixar kind of a thing or whatever. It was much less.
Where did that interest in CG come from?
I think, you know, growing up in New York, I didn't know a whole lot about the industry, and I certainly didn't know people who were in the movie making industry.
Right.
I grew up around advertising, so I certainly knew a bit of, like, you know, what it's like to do a shoot and then edit it and go into sound mixing studios and all that. I sort of had some exposure to media, but not to movie making per se. I think I just became fascinated, particularly with the rise of Pixar. You know, we got to remember, like, in the 90s and into the early 2000s was the explosion of the quality of rendering that Pixar was doing. I mean, I remember, like, when A Bug's Life came out, I was like blown away by the iridescent shaders on the beetle and, you know, all this kind of stuff. Right? I mean, they were really innovating. And so between that and the Final Fantasy movie and other things that were happening, I think I just thought that high-end CG animated stuff was just super cool, and I wanted to be involved in it, or visual effects, you know, just because it was the world creation, the wide digital matte shot. It was that, you know, the design world creating aspect of kind of movie making, as opposed to, you know, the filmmaking storytelling, you know, aspect. Anyway, the good news about being at PLF is that by being forced into Previz, I got a huge exposure to the live action side of things that I just had no idea about. You know,
right.
And I'll give a lot of credit to Colin and the overall approach. You know, I can't speak to what he's been up to lately, but at the time, you know, he sort of prided himself on being very technical about his approach. Right. And very accurate to the kind of film equipment that you'd be using and how you could sort of pre-visualize the limitations of that in order to figure out how you'd really do something. Right.
Sure.
And I think being exposed to that and the kind of precision that he brought to the process as an architect, as you and Eric also bring to it, right?
Right.
I think was great, you know, a great discipline. I certainly got some good habits from working for him and at PLF, I think, that have really helped me.
And he was historically a big soft image guy. You were.
It's as am I. It's kind of pathetic, but I'm still running it.
I'm
still running it. The truth is, these days I don't do a whole lot of 3D. If I do anything artistic, you know, with the management stuff that I'm doing, it's more Photoshop paint overs or whatever. Sure. And investing the time in doing 3D and setup and renders and all that. It's something that I used to do a lot, and I still really enjoy, but I just don't have the time for it. But So effectively, I kind of am just not a 3D user all that much right now at all. Right. But to be totally honest, I downloaded the Cinema 4D demo last night to try to stay up and start messing around with it. And God, I'm just the worst.
J.R.R. Martin, he writes all the Game of Thrones stuff on a DOS computer with WordStar.
Are you serious?
Yeah, because he says it's never crashed on me. Ever.
That's amazing. I wish I could say that of Softimage.
So Softimage is like, to you, is like, no, I'm sticking with it, because I, you know, I mean, it's a great package, and it is a shame. Yeah. I think it got it got, you know, what's the word?
The shaft.
Appropriated. The shaft. Yeah. it got deprecated in an unfair way because it was, you're right. It is a really good package, but unfortunately it didn't, it was just too much for Autodesk to maintain everything. So,
indeed.
But I think it's, it was really kind of interesting. I remember, talking to you about some of the stuff you guys were doing there. And it was an eye-opening to me as well, because to me, it was the first time I sort of like got to really be in a visual effects facility mm-hmm. and see how it was done, and seeing Colin, who was also an ex-architect, and seeing his perspective. So he kind of knew where I was coming from.
Yeah.
But you were showing me, some of the stuff that I don't know if you had done, but it was at least done their real, and it was figuring out how to shoot the plane crash sequence on Fight Club. And it was the previous, and it was all in Softimage, and you were showing like how the crane would operate and a motion control, and how everything would work. And I was like, oh, and it was like, it wasn't just about the CG, it was like how to make the shot work. And it was, you were saying, not only did this work, but this saved, lots and lots of time and energy for the director and the DP to figure out how the hell they're going to shoot this. Like, it's all planned, just do it this way and it'll work. Right.
Absolutely.
And it was the first time I started, I was still working in architecture time. I was like, oh my God, this is like, this is figuring stuff out. And of course it made sense, because like an architect would try to think of something like that, right? The mm-hmm. CG guys would like just want to focus on doing the CG and not worry about the other part.
Yeah,
so
it's true. Really... But an architecture background, where it's all about the precision required to make things work in the real world, right? Down to millimeters and fastener choices and everything else, right?
Right.
And engineered loads and tolerances and all the stuff that architects worry about. That's a good mindset for figuring out, the actual brass tacks of getting something shot. Precision is required, and CG, as I've discovered on Avatar, and other situations, obviously, CG is the ultimate playground of sloppiness if you want it to be, right? It just doesn't matter. Like, you can make something interpenetrating with another thing, and in the final render in the shot, if you don't see it, it just doesn't matter, right? There's a truth to that, but at the same time, it can kind of like give people what I would call somewhat bad habits, right? So
it's true. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I remember when I went to DD and I started working on Day After Tomorrow, and I had to build buildings, right? But I'd been mm-hmm. building buildings the whole time. I was like, oh, right. It's like, it's back there. Don't worry about it. I was like, oh, yeah, I don't. And I realized. So it was like architecture. I built everything to 1/8 inch accuracy, right?
Yes.
And in CG is like 1 pixel accuracy.
Right.
It's totally off by a pixel, it's okay. I was like, oh right. And it is, you're right, it is sloppy. But there is a lot of other things that become extreme, minutia of thinking about details in CG as well.
Well, that's right. That's right. The detail comes in different ways. And of course, the techniques of sub-D modeling and other of the softer, gooier aspects of CG. Mm-hmm. modeling and written rendering and that whole sensibility have made their way back into architecture,
Right. So, It's true. So somehow from the world of Previz and PLF, you migrated. And I remember when this sort of happened, you migrated into the world of art direction and became an art director. And he's like, yep, I'm doing this. And I've got, an art director. I'm an art director now. And I've joined a guild. And you basically like, I'm done with that. And I was like, that was fascinating. So explain that transition. How did that happen?
So look, I mean, I would say that, I started as that kid or that young person in New York wanting to get into movies. I definitely had an eye toward the design aspect of things. I think mm-hmm. I kind of didn't necessarily even realize the separation between design and execution in the film industry, right?
Right.
It was kind of all one thing to me. So if I saw a shot of a cool spaceship in a movie, I thought, it was all of one cloth. Whereas in fact, the truth is, there's a lot of different crafts that come together to enable that to happen, right?
Yeah.
The design sort of DNA of it was always in my brain, in my aspirations, but what was great about PLF was that it exposed me, number one, to the physical truth of the fact that there are art departments with cool, talented people who are sitting there being paid to draw and design exclusively, right?
Right.
So the experience of being on the Matrix sequels and being at the Eon you know, production place down in Venice and meeting, you know, George Hull and Simon Merton and these guys who were doing incredible work. I mean, in some cases it was digital, in some cases it was pencil, in some cases it was, you know, combination, Jeff Darrow, all these guys. So, you know, getting to pal around with them a teeny bit as I was had the courage to step outside the previs area and actually make conversation with these guys. I was exposed to that. I thought it was amazing. And then also, you know, PLF gave me the opportunity to do small scale visual effects projects where effectively there just wasn't the design input, right? You just doesn't, it was of a scale that there was nothing to work from. And so you had to design on the fly and in many cases just make crap up with right. very little input. Some of these, you know, music video directors just literally would give you no input, like, right. not a little bit, like none. You had to right. just make something up. And, but that was a great experience to be able to, you know, sort of think on your feet and design quickly and then execute that in CG quickly in a way that was somewhat efficient and all that. So I think, you know, at that point, I thoroughly set my sights on, I want to go into that world of art departments, but bring the CG skills and bring 3D skills, which was my main selling point at that point. You know, I'm still not the greatest 2D illustrator in the world, but it, certainly at the time I was, you know, stronger than average 3D illustrator. In fact, I was on the wave in such a way that I was probably one of the first that were kind of not just modeling and making awesome stuff in Rhino or whatever, but actually producing more rendered, well-lit looking images, right?
Right.
So I just, you know, I happened to be at that right place in that right time, learning those skills. And then I'll give a lot of credit to Ron Frankel, who actually left PLF to make his own company, Proof, which is still around. He gave me the chance to work essentially as a previs artist, but then transitioning into doing more rendered versions of the things I was working on. And then that was on The Terminal, Spielberg movie with Alex McDowell production designing. And right. that gave me the chance to get into the union as an illustrator, which is what I was for a long time. Before I ever art directed in film, I was an illustrator for many years.
Okay.
So that's where I made that jump. And from there on, you know, once you've paid your union dues of thousands of dollars, you want to make the best of it and stick with it. So I stuck with it.
Right, right. Well, that's interesting. I didn't know you worked with Alex McDowell as well. He's been mm-hmm. on as well, actually.
Right, we'll definitely have to listen to that one.
Yeah, he's interesting. He toured with the Sex Pistols for a while, so I don't know.
Did he? some of their graphic work was some of his earliest work, right?
Yeah.
Early paste-up poster type stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's mm-hmm. it's all his. He's a very interesting person. But anyway, so that sort of ended up, you know, getting you into that art director's world. And I think you worked on, you said the Transformer stuff, right? I remember some of your early Transformer designs. And it was one of the first times, honestly, that I, you know, I was so used to seeing, you know, as at that point I was working in visual effects, and I was so used to seeing basically traditional drawing concept art for so mm-hmm. long and saying, here it is, here's a sketch or whatever, make this, right? Mm-hmm. And I was like, mm-hmm. Okay. And it's just challenging. You have to make it from nothing, right? And you have to figure it
sure.
out. But it wasn't until I was on Tron that basically I got there and you guys were in, you know, next to us, right next to us, right? Mm-hmm. And so you was like, here's a model. You can use this at least as a base of something,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
it was like, wow, it was the first time you could see something in three dimensions and work with it in three dimensions that was concept. I remember, you know, talking to you on Tron, I was like, this is changing everything. This is making my life so much easier. and not only that, I think it was between Digital Domain and you, David Levy ended up sitting right next to me uh-huh. on the light bike.
He sequence. Stayed on, right? Yeah.
He did. And so he and I worked together on the light bike sequence. So he's like, that's not going to look right. Let me design a new light or let me design a new floor.
Yeah.
And he would redesign it and we would see it in the final shot, his design, like the next day.
Unbelievable.
I know that sounds like, okay, that's great. It's like it used to be like 2 years between the right. illustration and the shot.
Yeah.
And we were doing
yeah, yeah.
it in a matter of a day. Creatively, that's just such a better workflow.
It's
so
amazing.
Much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what typically happened in the old days, and I've been on, I think, both ends of this, is that there was just this information chasm between the production and the art department that was catering to the production and then post, right? There just
right.
There was a time gap. There was a personnel gap. You know, production designers were not held on for long enough to help handhold that transition well enough, right. You know, and it's probably not out of any lack of interest from the designers. It was more just kind of the culture, you know, that I don't know that the production side saw the benefit to paying some expensive person to stay on, to be involved in post. Didn't even make sense to them. But as we know, you know, as movies have gotten more digital and as there's scarcely a pixel of a shot that doesn't somehow integrate, you know, live action and virtual and have set extension and everything else, these kinds of crossovers are super important. And I think, you know, I give a lot of credit to Darren Guilford, who's a terrific production designer, and Joe mm-hmm. Kaczynski, who I know Joe had been at DD doing that test piece with you guys before. Were you involved in the teaser, the test?
I was not involved in the teaser.
Okay. No. But I mean, huge credit to him as a guy who, again, another architect, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody who's into computer graphics for their own sake and is kind of a geek about it, you know, seeing the benefit of really embracing digital filmmaking and digital look dev and all that stuff that you guys did so well in that teaser that we just kind of had to follow it in the movie to an extent anyway. Right. Anyway, a lot of credit to them, but they set up, I would say, you know, a really, really smart deal, which was, you know, that we had a big art department that was digitally savvy, I think, from day one, right? Yep. I mean, Darren himself, as an example, 3D modeled, you know, the giant rectifier ship himself in SketchUp, right? He modeled it himself. And the city, you know, we changed it and we improved it and we developed it more, but he modeled that city in SketchUp, himself.
Yeah.
So he's a guy who's very 3D now sounds, too.
But back then that was like a big deal. Like and I remember my friend, Christy, she's an art director as well. So she, actually, did she work on? No, she did not work on Avatar. Stefan worked. He was on the art department of Avatar.
Stefan Deckett was, yes.
Yeah. So his wife was, I went to architecture school with her.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so she was an art director and she was telling me she would come from architecture school and went to become an art director. And then they were like, she wanted to use a CAD program to sort of design how the building was going to be built on set. And we're like, no, it's like have to be drafted by hand. I'm like,
yes.
Why can't I? I mean, computers have been around for a long time. So it seemed like it was an uphill battle to get digital into art departments in some ways.
I think that's true. And I also think that something has been lost in the fact that digital won. You know, I sort of see that from both sides too. You know, anybody who's worked alongside pencil drafts people in an art department knows that there's partly it's a generational knowledge base that people who came up at that time had, which I think, and this is no denigration whatsoever to the 3D set designers that I work with constantly and are my companions and amazing and whatever. So I don't mean it that way, but there's a knowledge of just basic construction of the set of like how this will really get put together, you know, in a kind of a slightly more hands-on way because of the experience that people had, even if they weren't art directors, dealing with the foreman on set of how are you going to actually put the nails in the wood and make it happen. But also just the, you know, like, for example, you went to architecture school, but mm-hmm. I don't know. And I have not. Right. But I don't know how much you guys study traditional, you know, cornice moldings and, you know, Baroque, you know, decorations and the kinds of things you often need for movies, right, that you are so not popular in real architecture. I don't know how much that's studied anymore, but people in movies of that older generation of pencil pushers, they knew that stuff. They came up with it, you know?
Right. Well, it's interesting you say that because there was certain things that were lost just when I was going into architecture school, right? So, mm-hmm. And it was similar, you know, for example, we did learn about all the you know, because we knew that architecture was based on art history, right? So you mm-hmm. need, in order for you to do what you do now, you have to learn how you got here, right? Okay. So that was a good journey you have to take in terms of style. Mm-hmm. But in terms of skill sets, I was the first class in architecture school that did not have to learn how to letter, right?
Yeah, wow.
Right? So lettering is something that architects, as in architecture school, literally would learn how to write. It was like a calligraphy class you had to take every morning, and didn't have to do it because I said, you're probably never going to have to hand draft ever, right? Because at this point, CAD is going to take over. They already knew that.
Yeah.
And so CAD was still like the new thing. I was still drafting by hand because, you know, honestly, it was fun. But I was doing CAD as well. I was the digital guy, you know, at architecture school, but we did not have to learn how to letter. And so that was like a moment. They're like, you're never going to have to letter again.
Yeah.
And if you look at old architects and you look at how they write a check, it's like beautifully written.
It's beautiful. I know. Handwriting definitely has been lost in our culture in general, you know.
Yes, so exactly.
You find old letters.
So you're right. There is certain skills that are gone, you know, from that process.
And I also think, just to give another example, like let's say you are working on a medieval castle or a Gothic, you know, piece of architecture, whatever it is. There's a shorthand way to represent all that decorative detail, whether it's a sculptural figure that's holding up a bracket or whatever it is. There's a shorthanded way of sketching that in a 2D world that you can imagine doesn't translate to the 3D world, right? Now right. Suddenly you're expecting your 3D set designer to what? To know ZBrush and to like pose a cherub in a specific beautiful pose right. To hold? No, like either they're either not going to do it or they're going to do kind of like the ham-fisted version of it in 3D because it's a pain in the ass in 3D, right?
Right, right, right.
So you know, but someone traditionally could just note that down, and then a sculptor who's equally trained in all the details of what that cherub should look like because of their training, right, would jump in and take it over and push it. So I guess what I'm saying in a long-winded way is that there was, you know, in the more traditional world where I mean, number one, I love the fact that the digital world and everything empowers one person to do so much stuff, right? That's kind of what digital technology does, is it super empowers the individual. But there was something about the old ways that worked in the sense that each person knew what they needed to know and convey just enough information to the next skilled person that they can then finish it, as opposed to the explicitness and the detail level of a digital world where it almost demands that everything be really figured out all at once. You know what I mean?
I see. So, The shorthand is the thing, right? There's a way to just like, I get it. It's a boat. It's a car, right? Whatever, you know, and you can do that in three brush strokes, right?
Exactly.
And then otherwise like, no, you got to go to Turbo Squid, download a boat, find out like, you know, is it going to work? You just made it a lot more complicated. Exactly. It's true. I never thought about it that way, but that's great.
But that being said, I mean, look, I'm the first one to love the total anal retentive control that you have now to work with a super talented person in SolidWorks, for example, and make the model absolutely perfect. And then you work with either that person or somebody else in KeyShot and with Photoshop Paint or whatever to just tease something into looking exactly the way you want it to look, all within the art department, all in the digital world. You know, I love that level of control too. So I can see it from both sides.
Yeah. So you continue to use that kind of workflow that was working very much closer with the post world, right? You always had that mentality of like, I'm doing it in previs, but I know that what I'm doing in pre-production, but I know that everything I'm doing in pre-production is going to help people in post-production. So
absolutely.
I'm going to make that gap.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, well, to finish the point about Joe Kaczynski and Darren and the way they set things up on Tron. So at a certain point in time, when the main art department went to the production location in Vancouver, we, you know, the people that you saw at DD, we split off and formed that kind of splinter visual effects facing art department. And I think having a dedicated, you know, visual effects art department effectively is what we were, that had the cultural experience of being within the production, but now we're literally co-located with the visual effects artists. That was an amazing smart move. You know, I think you benefited from it. I think we did too, because it was, you know, it was the ultimate zero communication gap because we were sitting next to one another. And every time we handed something off, we could have an in-person meeting about it. Like, oh, here's this new model, you know, and someone would ask a question. Some visual effects person would say, well, why is that piece missing back there? And be like, oh yeah, I didn't think to point that out. You're right. We owe you another piece back there or that's being worked
or
on.
Even,
right there,
or even like a rig. Process. Yeah, if you had a spaceship that you designed, like the rigging department goes like, how's this supposed to work? You know, like
that's
you
exactly know? Right. That's exactly
so,
right.
Yeah. So they
may say like, can we trim off this little corner to enable this piece to not collide with something else as it pivots? Right. And you can just in one fell swoop just be like, oh yeah, I apologize. Absolutely, yes, go for it. You know, and then there's no rendering versions and worrying about it and all that shit.
Yeah, it was really, really beneficial. And you guys continue to do that. Obviously, that exercise continued when you guys worked on Ender's Game too, right? So you guys were both, didn't you work on Ender's Game?
Yeah. So I co-production designed Ender's Game with Sean Howarth, who's a terrific guy. And so that was unusual in that it was at the time a DD production, right? DD was one of the producing entities and put money into it and everything else. So we were at DD in pre-pro, which is obviously super unusual, right? You know, and Gavin, the director, was there, and we were all, you know, trying to work up this pitch package to attract other investors, basically, and other partners. And eventually when that, you know, when that went, we went off to New Orleans and shot down there. But we were at DD at the beginning. And I think we were at DD at the end, but not as much as we were on Tron. It wasn't, I mean, I think Tron was quite well budgeted. I mean, Ender's Game was, you know, cost some money to make, but it didn't, you know, it wasn't the same thing. So we kind of remotely were doing post contributions, you know, from home kind of thing. But for sure, I mean, it was the same process in the sense that, you know, I think as somebody who's been exposed to kind of a lot of aspects of, I mean, there's so much about filmmaking that I don't know and will never know. And it's kind of sad, but anyway, I've at least been exposed to a lot of the kind of the handshakes and the way that information is shared between different parts of a production on the digital side, especially, you know, I've made it my process or my mission to kind of in whatever I'm doing to really try to help that sharing, you know what I mean? So, as a production designer, I take that seriously. But even when I was an illustrator, I always thought it would be, you know, I almost looked at it as a privilege to be able to communicate directly with the visual effects team, the people who are designing, you know, doing the final modeling on the robots on Transformers or whoever it was I was working with, you know, to have a personal direct relationship with those people, to save out the models in the most careful way possible so that it's clear and it doesn't break, you know, to make sure that they import it properly, to, you know, to communicate all that intent. To make people's lives easier down the other end. And it's a privilege in the sense that you're in that way able to control the outcome also, you know what I mean? So, you know, so as a production designer, I try to take pride in the ability to save things out properly, share the information and, you know, do video conferences. And I'll say that the process in Avatar has been awesome, with Weta Digi, you know, we everything we hand off, we do our best to package the 3D and package the refs that go with it in the set and the other, but they have a process of making these ref package PDFs where they kind of boil it all together into something and bring their own reference. And Michael Smale is a guy who works there, who's doing a great job, bring their own reference to bear and put it all into one package of like, here's all the information. Do you approve it? Are we ready to go? And it's like, no, like change this reference for that reference. Da, da, da. And then, so no modeler or texture artist or whatever is starting on it prematurely before you've really communicated everything. It's really smart. So,
okay. And that's worked. I mean, obviously that's working pretty well. So that communication.
So far it's great.
With visual effects. Now that obviously that has a lot to do with the fact that you came from a visual effects world, or you understood the digital effects world, right? So, do you find that there are more people like you that have a background in CG or in visual effects that are in the art departments now, that it's that communication is becoming easier and better?
I think at this point, I mean, it's certainly on Avatar where we, you know, we had the pick of the litter, so to speak, in terms of hiring. And we specifically chose people who were a little more digitally savvy, a little more 3D oriented. Yeah, I mean, the name of the game these days is, as an illustrator or designer, is to just be kind of flexible and to know a lot of different techniques, right? So, you know, you can imagine the skill sets that were brought to bear were pretty mighty indeed. We've had, you know, can't say enough good about the people in our art department and the process of co-designing with Dylan Cole under Jim on this amazing thing. But basically, yeah, I mean, to make a long story short, I would say that everybody has some kind of 3D skills. I mean, they're, you know, and I think take a genuine interest in pushing the technological levels of what design and illustration are. I mean, every time I turned around, somebody had learned how to sculpt in VR and were doing like amazing stuff. And then before I know it, three guys in the same room are all wearing VR goggles at the same time. And they're all in Gravity Sketch doing, not messing around, but doing fundamental hard design problem solving using VR. And nobody told them to do that. They just kind of did it. So that's the great, you know, great thing of the openness and freedom of the art department world, where you don't have to, I mean, it's a disadvantage in the certain sense that it's kind of the Wild West and it's chaotic. Nobody uses the same package. File transfer is always a pain in the ass, this and that and the other, but it's the Wild West in a good way, in that it's, you know, is kind of like an incubator for people to just screw around and come up with new techniques, because it doesn't matter. There's no pipeline. The only pipeline is cool pictures and decent 3D geo going out the door, you know?
Right.
But everybody, you know, everyone got into the GPU rendering thing. Everybody started, you know, getting these, suddenly computers went from, you know, in the old days, a $6,000 computer, somehow it got down to 2,000, and now it's gone back up to 15,000.
Yeah, because of GPU costs.
Massive racks of GPUs. You know, but people
they, but that, that's interesting because, you know, like you said, I remember, I mean, we were, I'd visited you at one point, and you were talking. We were talking to a bunch of freelancers, or people that were working on Avatar, and everyone had their own computer, right? So it was their own system,
literally.
And because that's you hire me, and this is my you know, my drawing pads, basically. It's
that's
a computer,
right. Mm-hmm.
And they would buy these extensive computers. There was no pipeline; it was whatever you did. As a library of stuff that I have, right? Who was it? I forgot. Anyway, he just basically is like, here's all my stuff. And when I got to do something, I can just kit bash from this, or I have this. And it was like a process and his own scripts.
It might have been Fausto.
It was Fausto.
Yeah. Fausto is you know, MVP number one on my tech design side on Avatar. He's been with us for so many years and he's still with us now. So,
right. Yeah. But it was that kind of attitude. It's like, okay, so there's no pipeline. But it's everyone
like
makes their own
personal
pipeline, right? And so that was like, oh, that's interesting. And so when I was talking to some of those guys and helping them out with some of the stuff, I was like, oh, I need a specific tool for my pipeline or what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
But what's also interesting is that somehow there is needs. You are also kind of integrating yourself into the visual effects process, which has a much more rigorous pipeline.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That handoff, like, is there a way that you found that's like, okay, no matter what, we can do all this crazy stuff on our own, but at some point we got to go bloop, to something that's digestible to the process.
The main thing is just to test it out, you know, because so on that same guy, Michael Smale at Weta Digi, you know, we asked him early on to make us a table of the different file formats that they wanted.
Right.
And that included things like if somebody's native Max or native Cinema 4D or whatever it is, do you want that scene file as well? Just so you have the raw thing. You know, one day if somebody gets hit by a bus and, you know, you would at least have the real thing with the original, material pathing and all that stuff. Right.
Right.
So what we have is a table that he made that tells us which formats to save things out in. And so, everything goes out in, you know, Alembic and FBX and OBJ and some of the basics. But then you've got native, you know, if something was done in CAD, you've got a native Rhino or a native SolidWorks or native whatever it is, along with it. So they're kind of, as fully equipped as they can be. And they're within their rights to come back to us and say, this is corrupt, we can't open it or whatever. But by basically sending it out in so many flavors to begin with, we ensure that that doesn't happen. And it hasn't happened once.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think what was interesting to me as well, especially when I was on Tron, I was looking at stuff. One of the biggest reasons why you guys have to have your own personal little process that you do your things is the turnaround is so fast. You've got to come up with an idea and build it, texture it, project it, put it together with bubblegum and duct tape,
whatever
it takes, you know, and have it rendered in almost real time to put it in front of someone's idea.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, that's it. And then, so the iterative process of the design is what's very interesting. So how has that technology changed over time to make that process much faster for you?
Well, I mean, just to use Fausto as a great example of somebody who has a very developed personal pipeline. I think the thirst, and this is again, part of the cultural transition to digital in art departments and in productions in general, has not just been about going from, you know, traditional set design to CAD. But obviously there's an expectation now, you know, the Photoshop illustration revolution and then the 3D feeding into that, there's an expectation that things should look pretty finished and pretty real, right?
Right.
And I'm sure that's true of like architecture clients in the real world now too, right? That nobody basically knows how to read a plan anymore. People want, it's the show me state, right? Everybody wants to see what it's really going to be like, or they don't know what you're talking about.
Right.
It used to be that people knew what a sketch was, and now they don't, apparently. So, I think there's something lost there. I mean, and I'll give, a shout out to Jim Cameron, who, because he's an artist, and can just sit down and draw really well. Like, he can he can engage in critiquing a design, I think, in any level of presentation. Like you could draw something with a pencil and he'll understand what you mean. You could do the most finished render in the world and he'll get into that too. He will not be swayed into liking something just because it's well rendered at all.
Right.
He will happily reject some of the most amazing art ever because something is just conceptually off about it or whatever that is. So there are people who I think can see through the code of the matrix and can understand a design intent from any media or from any presentation. But that's not the norm. I mean, I think in general, and this is not, it's not really a criticism exactly, but it is a shame on some level, just that we are now all forced to operate at this kind of photoreal level all the time, like from presentation number one. And I don't think that's necessarily as true in games. I don't know why I'm saying that. I guess I'm just thinking of the amount of game artists I see online that have a more drawn style. That's just awesome. I mean, I love looking at art that's not as literal as the stuff that we have to do, but we're in that world. And so I guess when you look at like a Fausto, you know, he's got systems in place for working quickly where, you know, the system incorporates the look dev, so to speak, right? So he's got terrific, you know, metal shaders with edgeware and all this stuff built into them. You know, he doesn't have time to UV stuff and take it into substance and paint it up or whatever. He literally just doesn't have time. So he can use his kit and use his shader setups that are really richly developed. And they're very well organized, by the way. I mean, like, I saw it. Like all his kitbash parts are all in different categories and he's got it all visually browsable. And it's amazing. And I know I'm focusing on Fausto, but I, if anyone else is listening, I love all the rest of the art department people too. but anyway, so what that allows him to do is essentially throw stuff together, you know, throw some design spit on top of it and come up with a composition. And then it's essentially, you know, within 20 minutes, he can have some shaders chucked onto it and have a presentable by modern standards image, right? So that's what you're talking about.
And it was really surprising to me because, you know, I would look at the image and that's the thing that's also very, very, it was almost like hilarious to me because I was like, wow, that's a great image. I get it. Totally get it. And then you'd hand me the file. I'm like, this is a mess. But it looks so good. And I'm like, okay, I get it. That's how I got it done so fast, you know?
But
it's that process of like, because I would never have, you know, I would have worked to make it finished, right?
That's right.
And then I realized I'm probably spending hours to finish it when I really just need to get to that point and then render it and then little Photoshop on top and you're done, you know?
It was
like, oh, I get it now. And it was one of those things I was like, right. Now I understand how you guys are doing it so fast because it is especially in what you guys are doing, it's the idea of getting an idea out, right? Mm-hmm. It's not about the execution. It's like, do you get the idea? Yes, I do. Okay, you can take it over from here, but I expressed that idea and I got it out as fast as possible, right?
Yeah.
It's a really kind of a different mindset to think
about. Well, and don't forget that within the art department, you know, there are people who are much more nitty gritty in the same sense that some visual effects artists will have to take a rough model and turn it into something that has right topology and good UVs and everything else before you can put it into the movie. You know, there's CAD modelers and set designers, who have to do all that same stuff to, in some ways, an even higher tolerance level in order to manufacture things, right?
Imagine,
you know, the amount of work that it takes to get that down to 3D millable geometry that is going to, you know, be watertight when you stick it back together and all that kind of stuff. So I guess for me, you know, the pleasure of being a production designer and kind of working across the whole department and seeing all these different processes and seeing things go to the digital side and go to the practical side, because there's a lot of pleasures to really building stuff too. Is I think just getting to see the different temperaments that people have creatively and kind of technically and how they each bring something to the process that's unique and how you kind of need all of them, you know?
Right.
That's kind of what I was talking about a little bit with the example of the traditional set designer handing off a rough something to a sculptor who then knows what to do and kind of runs with it, right?
It's not that
way anymore exactly, although those things still go on. But in the digital realm, even you have a sort of a baton passing process that happens where each person adds their own expertise to it. And that gets right down to, you know, you've got your, I mean, I'll give an example, as far as I know, a unique example, but probably will become more and more common. our painter in New Zealand on Avatar, Ali Marr, is both a traditional paint supervisor and worked at Weta Digi as a look dev texture guy for many years. Wow. So he literally talks both languages. Like I can sit there with him critiquing something and to one of his crew, and I'll be like, dude, it's like, it just needs more breakup in the spec map, you know, like some kind of typical CG shorthand thing. And he can then literally translate as if it's a language to let's try this glaze applied with a sponge or whatever the hell, the, you know, the actual real world equivalent is, you know,
which is
great.
That's interesting.
But you have, you know, all those physical crafts where people are adding to the process and having to do interpretation and everything else too down the pipe. And so anyway, I just, you know, it's funny that everyone has their own temperament. Everyone has their own pace. You know, if you look at a person individually, you're sort of like, oh God, this guy's slower, that guy's faster, this guy gets impatient or, and I'm saying guy, and gender generic. Yeah. Don't think that I'm only talking about men. What's cool is that when you really look at what, at the end of the day, to what everyone's contributed and the way they've shared files and the way that they've built one thing on top of the other, if you as the production designer are doing your job of making sure that at each transition, at each handoff, it's getting better and not worse, then it's incredible what everybody contributes to it. And you can only get to like a super high level of product at the end of the day through the efforts of all these different types of people. So it's just fun, you know? Again, that's that Wild West thing. Like, it's not like there's some regulations in the union that we need a certain bunch of personality types like this and a certain number like that. It just happens automatically that in the community of people who are attracted to design and visuals, you get all kinds, you know, and they all serve their purpose. And I'm sure that's even true in visual effects facilities, right? That you have your specialists
Of course.
Who are really great at this thing.
What is interesting, though, in a visual effects world, and what's becoming more popular, and I don't think anyone really suspected it, is that generalists are coming back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because generalists seem to like, it's kind of like a Fausto situation. It's like, don't worry, I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
And they have enough stuff that they can make it happen. They don't have to go through a million pipeline process. And the generalists are becoming popular as these MacGyvers, you know, who can go in and take care of things. And I think that's an interesting idea as well.
I think a generalist, and at least to use Fausto as an example, a generalist is someone who's impatient enough to want to get the thing done and not let the process get in the way, not get hung up, you know?
Yeah.
And so it, as someone with that mentality or that temperament, you're going to develop tricks and you're going to develop shortcuts that work well enough, you know, and you're going to develop it among the different crafts that digitally kind of add up to a finished product. And so it's kind of a level of kind of urgency and impatience that is very useful. But you need the other people too. You know, you need the finishers. You need the people who can meticulously make something perfect too. It's just, you need to use the right gear for the right task. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So I want to ask you, I know you can't really talk too much about what's, you know, things that are currently in production, but I'd like to know how the role of the art department has changed, or do you think it will change, where it's going to go, virtual production is becoming a bigger part of the process, and how art departments are now sort of involved in that. Like, what's that like, and how is that going to change things?
Yeah, well, no, it's a pretty amazing opportunity, I think, you know, for art people to get their hands dirty again, so to speak. And when I say again, it's a little bit because, you know, it's a return to the old days in a certain sense, that there was a lot more, you know. There was a time back in the day, the studio system in Los Angeles, where you'd be an art director for the studio. You'd walk around the lot and you'd supervise the construction of 10 different sets for 4 different movies at the same time, et cetera, right? And there was a kind of a crafty, hands-on kind of quality to how you'd get that done, you know?
Right.
And I think that pulling, and also just in traditional filmmaking, there was a level of commitment you had to make that you just didn't have digital effects to fix everything later. You had to come up with really clever physical tricks of using mirrors or using whatever the hell, foreground miniatures, you know, all the great stuff that we look back on and revere, you know, all had to be done because it just had to be in camera. It just had to get done that way. And so I think I'm excited by virtual production in the sense that it brings some of that kind of hands-on craftiness that you need to have, and also the commitment to, like, we just rolled on that shot and it was like the LED screen was displaying. And guess what? It's done.
Right. You know?
there's no going back.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's different types of virtual production. Certainly, you know, that on Avatar, you know, we're striving for the absolute pinnacle of every aspect of what it takes to make a convincing performance and 3D image and everything else, right? So we're using technology in this kind of open-ended way, where you kind of always keep the balls in the air all the time. You always have options. You can always come up with a new virtual camera and all that. And you know, that's kind of what it takes to finesse things to the level that Jim wants. But I do think there's something cool about, you know, it's a little more old school, that with virtual production a la Mandalorian, it's like, nope, sorry, we shot it. Like, it's done.
Right.
You know? So I think that's cool. And I can't talk specifics. There's a little,
you can't
there's,
talk
there's,
specifics,
there's a,
but
no, but even about Mandalorian, I know a cool Mandalorian anecdote that I shouldn't know about.
Okay. So
it's like double that I'm not supposed to talk
but,
about.
But you, but you show, are, but, you are making things, you are making things basically that are going into shots, right? They are being shot in live or real time, right?
Absolutely. I mean,
so that's an
enormous
that's
an construction on Avatar. Yeah. You wouldn't think so. You would think that the lessons of the first movie, of how much we spent, into how much time we spent, you know, in the natural world of Pandora, and you know, how much we intercut between live action sets and that, and it sort of never jarred people really. I think it worked really well. You'd think like, okay, well, we now believe in the visual effects tech, you know, rendering hard surface stuff. Any visual effects artist will tell you that rendering hard surface stuff and shading it, whatever, is just a lot easier than complex organics, right? Right before they tell you that it's too expensive to do such and such thing digitally and you need to build it because it's really hard to do. They'll say both things. But anyway, the truth is that Jim, I think, just feels that he needs the live action, or that it's beneficial to the live action to anchor the film, you know, to make it look, to help the audience believe that it's all real. That's the reason we have live actors too, you know, portraying humans. It lays down a foundation so that the visual effects has something to live up to. Number two, so that your brain just kind of accepts the reality and will forgive the visual effects in the rare occasion that they fall down. And I think he just kind of likes it, truthfully. I mean, he's a filmmaker. He likes having real sets and real actors and just doing some of that stuff too. So we've built a lot more than I would have expected.
That is interesting. I also think it's interesting, you know, the other thing and you hinted at it just earlier, is like, you're not delaying the decision making. You have to make a decision now because it's going to be done. Right?
It's going to be done.
We'll just put a green screen back there and then we'll figure it out later. You know, it's like just delaying that having to make the decision right then and there. Yeah.
Well, also, we have simulcam, right? So, I mean, we're a thoroughly virtual production, both in the sense that we do, you know, full blown. I mean, I guess there's debate. I've heard you even debating it on one of your podcasts about what is virtual production? What does that term mean?
Right.
Obviously, it can mean different things, you know. And so, in the Avatar sense, on the one hand, it means the full blown performance capture process, right? Where you stage every damn bit of the action that you need. Even if it's background, even if it's horses being ridden, even if it's whatever, you don't animate it if you can possibly help it. You stage all that stuff with virtual, you know, not virtual, sorry, proxy sets, you know, gray sets, and everybody kind of knows what that looks like. That being said, you will be amazed at the size and complexity of some of the gray sets that we built on the sequels, like major, expensive, engineered steel, like big stuff, pretty crazy stuff. I think I lost the thread of what I was going to say. What was I going to say? I'm sorry. Simulcam. So at the same time, you know, we're taking full advantage of the fact that we, you know, we have this virtual camera capture system, right? So there's lots of live action sets that we built that Jim encountered for the first time, so to speak, as a filmmaker by scouting them virtually, right? On Avatar, we've got the art department, but then we've got what is sometimes called a virtual art department, which we call the lab, or the environments team within the lab is really more accurately what it is. And so, you know, we hand off things to them long in advance of worrying about handing off the model to visual effects. We're handing it off to the lab, which is its first chance to get ingested into the whole system, right?
Interesting.
So they make it into a real-time lighter version, you know. In some cases, they've made gorgeous real-time assets that are like up to the level of good game assets almost.
Right.
And so the virtual, you know, between what they've done and the gazebo real-time render that we use, which is a proprietary Weta Digi thing, some of our virtual looks good. I mean, it's pretty amazing, you know.
Right.
But basically, so Jim has already encountered a lot of these sets virtually before he ever saw them in person, right?
Interesting. Yeah.
So what that allows us to do in some cases, we've never done this perfectly, but in a perfect world, you would literally have him scout it and then debate with him what the extent of physical build would be standing out there in the volume, right? Like, okay, Jim, here's our proposed, you know, all right, switch the visibility, show the extent of build and have him experience that out in the volume. We never actually did that. We were fully prepared to, but it just didn't have the time. But effectively, we've designed these environments as full virtual worlds first. Then you debate endlessly, including debates with visual effects and debates with your own budget and everything else. What are we going to build? What do we need to build? What can we afford to build, et cetera? And then later on, the part that's not what you built, right, becomes the simulcam package, so to speak, for what's running virtually in his tracked camera on the day, right?
Okay.
So a lot of effort actually, you know, like for getting ready for a live action day on Avatar has been not just making sure the physical set is ready, which is of course the priority, but but making sure the simulcam is right. Because sometimes he's got stuff that he needs to be framing for, right? That's totally critical to, you know, either the architectural composition of something or characters, more importantly, obviously the characters walking through, et cetera. You know, that's gotta be sussed out really nicely or else he's framing the wrong thing. So it's virtual even on the days when we're shooting live action, big time.
Right. That's interesting. I find that the world of the virtual sets are going to become much more important. Things have to be more real time. And so what virtual production is going to do, it's going to bring back some of those sensibilities of traditional filmmaking, right? And suddenly you're not going to be stuck in this thing where it's like just wait and go in a process and wait, you know, have one version a day, right? Because that's the way the visual effects world is. You know, it's like, no, you're going to have, you know, 100 versions in a day because you need to get it right then and there. And it's that there's time and money spent on sets. And now suddenly you have to, you know, that has to be a process that's going to be very interesting. So I think the roles of art departments are going to become very, very interesting. And people that work in art departments are going to have to be savvy enough to be like, yeah, no, build it. It's like you're building the thing, you know? You're the designer and the carpenter at the same time.
Well, exactly. I mean, someone in that position has to say simultaneously, like walk over to a set painter and be like, you need to, you know, whatever. You need to weather this down with some kind of rusty, oily composition in this corner, whatever it is. And then walk over to an Unreal artist and say, you know, you need to, again, like I said before, you need more breakup in the spec map. You've got to be talking both languages all of a sudden, and which is, you know, I think that's cool. And I would say that a lot of more modern art department people, I think, are pretty well equipped to do that.
Right. Well, I'm glad we're finally able to do this podcast. We're just over an hour. And as we mentioned before, we are going to do another podcast once Avatar comes out so we can talk more details about that, obviously, which is going to be very exciting. You know, it's cool that we finally did this. You know, it's interesting now that they're doing, I'm doing these remotely, I'm actually getting a lot more people that are like, oh, yeah, I guess I'm stuck at home. I can do a podcast.
Perfect opportunity. Well, thank you for pursuing me for such a long time. I'm sorry that I've probably flaked out a little bit here and there in terms of
getting spawned,
but I'm very happy to do it. And I will have endless things to talk about Avatar in much more detail.
Yeah.
Later on.
It's been your life for 7 years.
It has been. Yeah. And who knows when it's going to end.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Ben. I appreciate it.
Awesome. Well, great. It's been really fun. Thank you so much.